Weather Brains.
This time on Weather Brains, remembering back to the early days of television weather.
I'm old enough to be part of the generation that actually started by drawing on a plexiglass mat, you know, with magic markers.
Lots of memories, too, of a long, hot summer.
In Dallas, they had temperatures exceeding 100 degrees for 69 days in a row. Can you imagine that?
We look back at the heat wave of 1980.
The heat was so bad that the I-40, one lane of it, buckled and they had to close it.
Also this time, thoughts on how the National Weather Service is trying to meet one challenge.
I just don't think that's the way to go.
Plus, on Weather Brains 101, Professor Peters looks at lightning. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray looks at the loss of hope 5 years ago and when a dying thunderstorm makes crops burn. You'll hear about that. Plus, should Weather Brains go video?
We all look good on the radio.
Yep, we do.
That and more coming up. It's episode number 72 of Weather Brains, the netcast that's all about weather, produced by The Weather Company. Hey, I'm David Black. With me for this ride, James Spann, J.B. Elliott, and Brian Peters. Hey, J.B., how are you?
I'm the same as I was exactly a week ago when you talked to me. No change. I haven't changed since 30 minutes after I was born.
Sometimes I've asked you how you were before, and you would say C+. Is that the same grading scale now, or are you up to a B?
That's the highest I've ever been, is C+.
Okay, speaking of high, no, I'm not going to do that. Brian Peters, how are you doing? I couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
I'm doing great. It's not too many weeks that you get to experience high temperatures in the 60s and then high temperatures in the mid-90s.
Yeah, you're back from some pretty fun travel, it sounds like, to points up north, including where? Chicago? Where else?
Chicago and Cleveland. Actually, I had a workshop in Cleveland, and then I stopped in Chicago to visit my daughter, and I got to see two things that we don't see in central Alabama very often.
Okay.
Cool air and rain.
Outstanding. Mm. Yeah, we could use some of that. And is your daughter helping spread the word among Chicagoans about Weather Brains?
Oh, absolutely. She loves the show.
Okay, very good. James Spann, how are you, man? What's new?
You know, soon Brian's going to publish two new books, A Visitor's Guide of Stealing Wi-Fi in Chicago and Cleveland. So be looking for that.
He probably found it to steal at some of the finer restaurants in Chicago, and I understand there are many.
Some guy actually got arrested. He was sitting out in the parking lot in front of a coffee shop checking his email or something. You know?
For real? Where was this?
I need to dig up the story, but they actually arrested the guy. And
for stealing Wi-Fi?
Stealing Wi-Fi. And now the coffee shop owner had nothing to do with it. It was just some police officer saw this guy and didn't quite understand what was going on there. And I think he's actually up. His sentence was probation or something. But
Brian, you paying attention?
Brian, better be careful.
I'm careful. I now have a new express card for my MacBook Pro, so now I don't have to steal it. I can just pull it out of the air.
Weather Brains is almost turning into the MacBook Pro show. Everybody's got Apple Mac computers.
Well,
yes, sir.
75% of the show participants this evening have Macs.
Thank you very much. Well, actually, I do have a Mac. I just don't have it the way you guys do. I have it in a business application that it's a desktop, and it's a wonderful system. So I do
It's not an Apple II, is it?
Excuse me, Mr. Spann. It is an Apple Plus. Get it right, okay?
David and I actually used an Apple IIe to generate weather graphics for the NBC affiliate in our market back in the early 1980s.
Yeah.
And that was big time.
That was high tech. That really
was.
It was.
I mean, let me tell you what, it didn't get any better than that. It was just fascinating.
There was nothing else out there. There were no other PCs. There were no on-air weather display systems that would do what that little Apple at that time would do, were there?
And I'm old enough to be part of the generation that actually started by drawing on a plexiglass map, you know, with magic markers when I started doing weather on television. And I did that for a year and a half, and then we got that Apple IIe, and I thought it would never get any better than that.
Okay, James, I want to ask you something, and maybe Brian, you or JB will have some thoughts on this too. You touched on something that I really did want to mention on this program. I was thinking about this earlier, thinking back to the early days in my childhood of watching television news and weather, and of course it's just matured in an incredible degree, but do any of you guys remember, I saw this watching television as a child in my hometown in Texas. Any of you guys remember seeing weather people with clear plexiglass types of maps of the U.S., the 48 states, and instead of drawing on them from the front to the back, they did it backwards.
Yep.
They had some kind of shoe polish or something, but they wrote the numbers backwards from behind the screen, the glass, so that they would look normal to somebody watching on camera.
There was a guy in Columbus, Georgia that did that, and that was absolutely fascinating. And the other thing, I can't remember what marketer who did this. There was a guy that would take his chalk. I mean, we're talking
blackboard chalk?
Yeah. And he would, you know, do his maps with a chalk, and at the end of the weathercast, he'd flip that thing up in the air, and it would land in his pocket. And the guy never missed. I mean, he never missed. And I bet you somebody listening to the show would know who and what market that would be, but I've seen old film of that, and the guy was tremendous.
And I remember,
I think that may have been in Fort Myers, Florida, James.
It's possible. I don't know.
But I think I remember somebody in Fort Myers who used to do that.
Well, didn't Ray White do it here?
Well, Ray White drew with a you know, looked like a glue bottle or something, but I never saw Ray flip the chalk.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
and I remember seeing weather people at that time. In addition to writing the numbers backwards, they would draw fronts with the little triangles and warm fronts with the semicircles, all backwards from behind the plexiglass. And I just wondered, how did they do that? That had to take some practice.
I was never that talented. I did it frontwards.
Well, speaking of dating ourselves, along those same lines, I was thinking back to what kind of weather coverage existed back then, and basically there was none. I really very seldom remember seeing any kind of special weather coverage. I remember very vividly as a child when a tornado warning was issued one time when I was visiting a relative in a small town in the panhandle of Texas, black and white television days. I remember seeing a live camera image of the radar, weather radar, showing a tornadic thunderstorm, and it was this big, blurry, fuzzy blob of white.
White one.
Yeah, and I don't know what you could tell from it except that it sounded scary from the way it was being described, and it looked pretty scary, but that was the extent of any kind of visual graphics or information, as I recall, being available back then. You guys remember anything different?
I don't.
It was you were on your own.
That was it. I got into this business in 1978, and at that point, we had the digitized WSR-57 radar stuff. And I remember that as a little boy, David, clearly, the old black and white images. And even where I grew up, there was no radar. I mean, you know, they might give you a tornado warning if they had somebody there that could do it, but there was no long-form coverage, and it was pretty primitive. In fact, back in the late 70s, I thought one of the coolest things I've ever seen, we built this huge map, and you might remember this, David. It was mechanical, and we had these light bulbs behind every county in the state, and we would throw a toggle switch for the counties that were under a watch and another switch for a warning that would flash that light bulb.
Wow.
And, you know, as crude as that thing is,
it worked.
It looked good on the air, and it worked, and it made its point. With that Apple IIe and that, you know, light bulb thing with a map, I mean, I thought it would never get any better than that.
Don't you wish you had that for a broadcasting museum or something today?
Really?
We just have incredible memories. And the last memory I have is not really as weather-related, but maybe you guys will recall this too. Again, I grew up in the state of Texas, and the television stations there, as was the case, I'm sure, around the rest of the country, had virtually no news on in the morning hours. There were no network news shows to speak of. Of course, you know, today's show's been around for a long time, but not the way that it is now. And I remember very clearly the ABC affiliate in my hometown for quite some time ran the CBS morning news because they had no news programming of their own, and there was some programming conflict on the local CBS affiliate. So that was really strange to watch the station we all knew was the ABC affiliate, but for an hour or whatever the time was in the morning, they ran CBS's network news. Just kind of goes to show what a dramatic change has happened with all the information explosion and the abundance of news and weather information available today.
I remember the first day that coaxial cable reached our city, and up until that time, everything was syndicated or pre-taped or live locally, but no network.
Yeah, tell you what, it's a different era now. James, we've been talking about television and the media. Let's switch gears a little bit and kind of get into an informal roundtable. Not that we're not in one, we're already in one. Heat, temperatures, heat waves. We've got some dry weather going on across the eastern and southern states. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, you know, my topic I wanted to talk about was the first really serious heat wave I ever had to deal with. And this really kind of flows into the talking about the old days of my television career. The second summer of my television weather career was 1980. And, you know, a lot of people are getting a little edgy about this summer. It's so hot and so dry for so much of the country. But in 1980, it was just staggering. And the ultimate statistics, I mean, I don't think we know how many people died as a direct result of that. I've heard numbers anywhere from 1,200 to 10,000. But the numbers just really spoke for themselves. In Dallas, they had temperatures exceeding 100 degrees for 69 days in a row. Can you imagine that?
Man.
Between June 23rd and September the 6th. And during that time, they hit their all-time high of 113 in Wichita Falls, Texas, which is a famous weather city, not only for heat, but for tornadoes. They hit 119 degrees. And for that community, that is just staggering. And, you know, there was tremendous loss of life, and it was so long-lasting. And I hope this doesn't turn into that, but just the start of this summer makes me think of that. And the one thing, David, that happened that really I don't think anybody remembers that much were these incredible mesoscale convective systems that formed in the periphery of that. There was one called the Moortrees Down Derecho that was on July 5th, 1980, and it moved from eastern Nebraska to Virginia in 15 hours.
Wow.
And that thunderstorm mass killed six people and injured about 70.
The whole complex just stayed intact the whole time?
It stayed intact all the way from around Omaha to Richmond, Virginia. And it was just incredible. So while many people dealt with the incredibly hot and dry weather on the periphery, on that ring of fire, you had those things firing. So that was a fascinating case study in United States heat waves. And again, I hope this year doesn't turn out to be like that. I don't think it will, because quite frankly, the drought is fairly confined to a small area. But that was a nasty, nasty summer. It was bad.
Yeah, confined to a small area, but getting worse all the time for some of those small areas with increasing water restrictions going into effect. Everybody's wanting a tropical system to form and bring some relief to that. J.B. Elliott, what's new with you?
We were camping in the high mountains of southern Utah during that 1980 heat wave, and when we went west on I-40 through Little Rock and Oklahoma City, the heat was so bad that the I-40, one lane of it, buckled and they had to close it. So that caused a huge traffic jam. And we came back through Dallas-Fort Worth the day the heat wave broke. So we missed the whole thing, really.
Man, you're lucky. Brian Peters, what about you?
Well, 1980 brings back memories for me, too. I was a forecaster in Memphis at the time. And just like where James was, we established an all-time record high. If my memory serves me correctly, it was 108 degrees, and lots of deaths. And I agree with what James said. I don't know that the number has ever really been firmly established. It was one of those things where heat and cold became recognized as being unprecedented killers. I mean, you don't usually think of the heat and the cold as killing, but that summer, the heat really did a number on the eastern part of the country. I don't remember the complex James was talking about, but I do remember that in the forecast business, of course, you are always comparing your numbers, what you forecast, against the MOS numbers from the computer. And it was so wonderful because every day Memphis had a high in the lower 100s, that is 100 to 108, and guidance would always tend back towards climatology. So on day two, you were always making 10 and 15 degree points on your forecast, because you could, you know, it's very easy. You just forecast 102 or 104 and you would get it. But the guidance was trending back towards 94 or 93. So you were always making good points on the model guidance that year.
That happened today in our part of the world. The day we're recording this program, the guidance, I think, had 90, and we had one spot today that hit 101. And the soil is dry, and you know, the dew points are low, so sometimes moss products are useless in anomalies like this.
So for folks in the eastern and southeastern part of the country, James, I guess the only relief really is for just scattered afternoon storms, nothing organized and prolonged on the horizon.
You know, I really think that parts of Georgia and the Carolinas and even North Florida might see some pretty good rain here the next couple of days, David, with a trough that's kind of parked over the East Coast. These systems come down the backside of that. Big batch came down today, and I think they might see more of the same for the next 2 days. But when you get over to Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi, Arkansas, the hope is not good.
Okay.
Good at all.
Well, some people in the news this time. This sort of ties back in a way to Brian Peters, who used to be employed by the federal government, National Weather Service. The Weather Service has a new director. He's Dr. Jack Hayes, who takes over September 2nd. NOAA Administrator Conrad Lautenbacher calls Hayes a seasoned professional. For the past 18 months, Hayes has served as director of the World Weather Watch Department at the World Meteorological Organization. Now, prior to joining the WMO, Hayes served in several senior positions in management at NOAA, so he's coming back to the government. He's also served as director of the Office of Science and Technology for the National Weather Service. Weather Service has some challenges ahead with budgets and image issues through NOAA. We heard about that from William Proenza, Hurricane Center Director. We'll have to see what Dr. Hayes' take is on these things and see what sort of a Weather Service director he becomes when he takes office.
That will certainly be interesting.
Did you ever have any dealings with him when you were in the Weather Service?
Air it out. What's the scoop on this guy?
Oh, I'm afraid I really don't know him. In the field of weather, it's a rather small field, and so you hear names and you feel like you know them because they're names that pop up, and his is a name that I certainly know, but I do think the National Weather Service faces a lot of challenges, and one of the challenges that I think that they're failing at the moment is trying to reduce the importance of field offices. And I know when Bill Proenza was the director of the Southern Region, I do know during my time there before I retired that he was the only regional director that was really outspoken about the need for field offices and the importance of them. And I know one of the problems the National Weather Service faces is budgets. We all face that kind of problem. But when your budget is on the order of 90% or slightly higher weighted towards salaries, the only way you can cut budgets is to cut salaries or to cut positions. And so there's really no alternative for the Weather Service to do that. And yet, I think they do such a good job, and especially in the warning process, I just don't see how they can eliminate field offices completely. But I do see a trend towards possibly establishing either a national or perhaps regional centers and reduce the emphasis on local forecasters to regional or national centers, and having maybe a small staff on the order of, oh, I don't know, four or five or six that would do severe weather outreach and then also be called into service during warnings. And I just don't think that's the way to go. I really think forecasters need to be forecasting the weather and then be able to interpret for severe weather, and if they don't have that forecasting skill, I just don't see how they're going to keep their severe weather skills up, but that's my opinion.
So, Brian, does that, with that plan, is the thinking there to reduce the number of offices that actually write forecasts so that your forecast might be written by people much farther away in a more regional setting? Is that the thinking?
I believe so, and I think you can look at the forecasts right now. They're being generated by a human, but they're computer-worded forecasts. That is, a human creates a grid of numbers, and the computer then takes that grid of numbers and generates a worded forecast. Well, it's not a hard step, even somebody with no imagination, to assume that, well, okay, what does MOSS put out? It puts out a table of numbers. So why don't we skip the middleman? We can stop paying the forecasters.
Right.
Just eliminate them completely and have the MOS input go straight into the computer worded forecast. And James just brought out a really good point. When the MOS is good, it's good. But when you get situations like we're dealing with right now or the summer of 1980, it doesn't do well because it doesn't pick up on the patterns that are there that are going to persist. And it wants to tend back towards what it thinks is climatology for mid-June or mid-July or whenever.
So really, no matter who's in control there, it just seems like over the past decades, the Weather Service has always been in this tremendous budget squeeze about people in management trying to find ways to cut operational costs. And yet, the Weather Service is not a huge investment out of the government. It's not, you know, a particularly large money-draining agency.
No, as a matter of fact, the employee population of the National Weather Service, I believe, is something slightly less than 5,000 people, and that's nationwide. And I can't remember what group did this before I retired from the Weather Service. A group figured out that for every dollar spent on the National Weather Service budget, it returned benefits. And these were very conservative benefits. It returned benefits tenfold. In other words, if you put a dollar into the Weather Service budget, you got back benefits that equal $10.
Yeah. I hear similar things about NASA as well. So just a constant fight over money, no doubt about it. A listener phone call to check out. James, I'm going to put you on the spot and let you answer the listener call, okay? See what we think.
James, Weather Brains. I like your podcast. It's very informative. And also, I was wondering if you do like a video podcast to like show some of the stuff you're talking about. But I can understand bandwidth, cost, and all that stuff. But I like the podcast. Keep it up, guys. Later.
What do you think?
You know, we've been talking about this for, what, a year? I think it's about time. What we need to do, there's two things I really want to do. Number one, I want to try it live, in audio one night, and maybe do talk show or something. But I would love to try a video show one week and just see what happens.
Brian, that means no more open shirts with hairy chest.
Means I have
socks
to put on something besides my underwear?
No, socks and Bermuda shorts.
I don't want that.
Oh, gosh.
I don't want that visual.
He worked in the weather office with that one day, and we may turn around and leave and come back.
That's sad.
I've heard Span say this a number of times. We all look good on the radio.
Yep, we do.
We've been told we have a face for radio. JB, you're staying suspiciously.
One of these nights, we're going to do that. We're going to gather together. We've got a television studio here, and knock this sucker out with the TV lights and everything else and just see how that works.
JB, are you going to be a part of that party?
Yeah, I guess. I would like to.
You're not scared about your reputation or anything now if you were to get in some kind of video thing?
It can't get any worse.
Well, that's true. You are already associating with the Weather Brains crew. So, all right, moving on. Time for the Weather Center this week. First, it's class time again with Professor Peters and Weather Brains 101. This time, the distinguished professor brings us a lesson on lightning. I think you'll find this interesting, too. And following that, it's This Week in Weather History with Bill Murray. Now, this is a very noteworthy week in history for a man whose name became synonymous with tornado research. And another man's death 5 years ago this week meant that Hurricane watchers lost hope. Here are the details.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
Summertime has particular significance in the field of weather. Weather enthusiasts know that June 1st signals the start of hurricane season. But summer also brings another dangerous phenomenon that comes from thunderstorms, lightning. Lightning is an atmospheric discharge of electricity. During the summer, scattered air mass thunderstorms are common, plus the warm weather brings us time for enjoying outdoor activities. At any one moment, there are as many as 1,800 thunderstorms in progress somewhere on the Earth. That's 16 million storms a year. Wow. Lightning develops in the cloud as water droplets and ice crystals rub and bounce together. Initially, positive and negative charges exist throughout the developing storm, but with time, those charges become separated, with the positive charges in the top of the thunderstorm and negative charges in the lower portion of the storm. As the charges grow stronger, the electrical potential becomes greater, until at some point, the insulating quality of the air can be broken down and the lightning discharge occurs. There are many types of lightning and a host of different names. I think of lightning in four categories: in cloud, cloud to cloud, cloud to ground, and cloud to clear air. There's also a special kind that we're not likely to see unless we're on the space shuttle, and that's cloud to ionosphere lightning, with names like Elves, Blue Jet, and Sprite. In-cloud lightning is a discharge inside a thunderstorm, while cloud-to-cloud refers to a discharge between different storms. Cloud-to-ground is the discharge between the storm and the ground, and that's the most dangerous kind. Cloud-to-clear-air is a rather rare type and often very hard to see. Some interesting facts about lightning. Each second, there are 50 to 100 cloud-to-ground lightning strikes to the Earth worldwide. Most lightning strikes average 2 to 3 miles in length and carry a current of 10,000 amps at 100 million volts. Lightning deaths are underreported. In the United States, lightning deaths average 61 during the last 30 years. Think you might not be at risk? Your chance of being struck in any one year is 1 in 700,000. But over your lifetime, about an 80-year lifespan, it's a 1 in 5,000. So heed lightning's own warning, the thunder. When thunder roars, stay indoors. That's WeatherBrains 101 for this edition. If you have questions about weather terms, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Let's look back at some interesting weather history for the week of June 12 through the 18th. Famed tornado researcher Ted Fujita had been studying the destructive storm since 1948, and he had made many important scientific discoveries, but had never seen a tornado in person until June 12, 1982, when he caught his first live tornado in Colorado. It was back on June 13, 1984, that a huge hailstorm struck the Denver, Colorado area. Some of the stones measured an amazing 4 inches in diameter. Many locations experienced golf ball-sized hail for 40 continuous minutes, and snowplows had to be called out to clear the roads of the hail. 90% of the roofs in Lyman, Colorado were damaged and 20 people were injured. Damages totaled nearly $350 million from the storm. Now, one of the most familiar and trusted faces on the Weather Channel was always that of veteran hurricane forecaster John Hope. The hurricane expert passed away on June 13, 2002, following complications from heart surgery. He was 83 years old. Hope joined the National Hurricane Center in 1968 and quickly became a senior hurricane specialist. He started with the Weather Channel as their tropical expert when the network debuted in 1982. He was a familiar and reassuring face to millions of Americans in coastal areas. The little town of Copperell, Texas is located about 50 miles southwest of Fort Worth. Back on June 15, 1960, a dying thunderstorm formed a pocket of cold air in the upper atmosphere up at about 20,000 feet. Now, since cold air is heavier, it begins to sink, and as it does, it encounters higher pressure and warms through compression. The rate of that warming is 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit per 1,000 feet. Now, as the air sank, it warmed to around 140 degrees. When it reached the ground, the winds fanned out at about 75 miles an hour. Now, people all over the area had to wrap themselves in wet blankets to protect themselves from the heat. Crops in the area were burned to a crisp. Now, the deadliest tornado of 1978 was a weak tornado, even an F1. It struck a showboat, though, called the Whippoorwill on Pomona Lake in Kansas. 58 people were aboard as it left the dock for a dinner cruise. 16 people drowned when the tornado capsized the boat. Now, ironically, back on June 18, 2001, the sirens didn't sound in the tiny Minnesota town of Siren when an F3 tornado struck. Warning sirens had been knocked out by storms earlier in the spring and were scheduled for repair that week. An important lesson from the siren storm: sirens should not be depended upon for receiving warnings. That's this week in weather history.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bill Murray. Next week on Weather Brains, experts tell us it's only a matter of time before another hurricane like Katrina strikes again. The question is where? Well, concern is growing about one spot on the U.S. coastline experts fear could become the next New Orleans. Folks there got zapped by Hurricane Beulah, and the area is even complete with an aging levee system. What kind of shape are the levees in?
They're not in adequate shape to handle another Beulah-sized flood.
It's a Weather Brains Extra, the next New Orleans. Join us next week as we talk with a man who knows the risks firsthand. And a personal note from Weather Brains, we're giving our best wishes to Weather Brains crew member Kevin Selly, who's been taking some sick leave. We are hoping he might be able to be back with us next week. He's on the road to recovery, so that's good news. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks here at Weather Brains, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. If you want to send a get well message to Kevin, send one straight to him, kevin@weatherbrains.com. If you want to leave a toll-free voicemail for us, our number is 1-888-247-8627. That's 1-888-247-8627. For the Weather Brains crew, James Spann, J.B. Elliott, and Brian Peters, I'm David Black. We do thank you for listening and hope you can join us for the next episode. Weather Brains is copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Adios.
I think Kevin's slacking. He's just trying to get some sympathy.
Oh, we'll see if anybody sends any messages to him and what they say.
Mm-hmm. I really don't, envy him having back trouble.
No, not fun at all. We miss him. He's a fun part of this group, and he's part of the Weather Brains family. So I really, and I know he's been going through a lot, and Tracy's been taking good care of him, and they are good folks. And I just really hope that he can make it back soon. It'll be fun to have him back on board.
Very nice guy. He's got to get this pencil neck thing, but other than that, really nice guy.
Got to get a real picture of him, too, up on the WeatherBrains website.
That's an inside joke, but Kevin will know what I'm talking about when he hears that.
Does that go with the hat?
The news director, when we worked together in television, this was...
in Birmingham, Alabama.
13, 14, 15 years ago. Kevin, you're doing a great job, but man, you got this long neck problem. And he made Kevin go get these specially designed shirts with these big old tall collars. That would mask this alleged neck problem that nobody figured but the news director. So it's a strange business.
Okay.
That it is. He's always going to be a long neck geek to me.
Pencil neck geek?
Pencil neck geek. That's it.
All right. You guys be good. Had fun. Enjoyed it.
Thanks. See you, boys.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye.